Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the Scholarly Communications channel on the New Books Network. My name is Jen Hoyer, and today I am joined by Cynthia Cross, John Wright, and Bongiseni Buthelezi, who have all worked together on editing Archives of Times Past, published in 2022 by Wits University Press. Archives of Times Past is an exploration of the archive on Southern Africa's past in the pre-colonial era, bringing new ideas about source material and archiving from scholars in Southern Africa and elsewhere. It focuses on the question, how do we know or think we know what happened in the times before European colonialism? This book includes essays by well-known historians, archaeologists, and researchers to engage these questions from a range of perspectives and in illuminating ways. Written from personal experience, they capture how these experts encountered their archives of knowledge beyond the textbook. The essays are written at a time when public discussion about the history of Southern Africa before the colonial era is taking place more openly than at any other time in the last 100 years. Cynthia Cross is an honorary research associate of the History Workshop at the University of the Witwatersrand, Johannesburg, and an honorary research associate at the Archive and Public Culture Research Initiative at the University of Cape Town. John Wright is Emeritus Professor of History at the University of KwaZulu-Natal and a research associate in the Archive and Public Culture Research Initiative at the University of Cape Town. Bongiseni Buthelezi is the Executive Director of the Public Affairs Research Institute. Cynthia, John, and Bongiseni, welcome to the New Books Network. I would love if we could start off with each of you sharing a little bit about yourselves, where you grew up and completed your studies, how you became interested in and connected with archives, and how all of you connected over writing this book. And Cynthia, maybe we could start with you.
Thanks, Jen. Thanks for the introduction. I was actually born in Zimbabwe, but moved to Johannesburg as a child with my family. And I studied history at the University of the Witwatersrand, commonly known as Wits. And I was encouraged, I had never thought of this, but I was encouraged to do postgraduate studies. And that's where I really encountered the archive and discovered that history was a very exciting discipline. I ultimately completed my PhD at Wits, and I started my working life as a history teacher, and then later returned to Wits as a lecturer in the history department, where I taught for many years. I had heard of John because of the James Stewart Archive, which I came to use in my own teaching, and I admired it very much, and I felt his work very inspiring. But because I'm just a few years younger than John, and I like to think that I was kind of in the avant-garde of the left and so on, and I used to quite often challenge John, kind of follow him around to conferences and so on, and spring out of my chair and say, "But Professor Wright." So it's quite funny because that's the image I really have. And then John approached me saying he had an idea for a book, and I thought, well, why on earth is he talking to me after all our arguments over the years? But of course, that was a fantastically stimulating thing about it. Mugoseni, I think I really met through John, but had also heard of him and read his work. And so I came to know him later, but really appreciate my collegial relationship with him.
Thank you. And John.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. I grew up in Natal province, as it was then, in South Africa, now KwaZulu-Natal. I studied history at the University of Natal in Pietermaritzburg, and then later at the University of the Witwatersrand. Both my MA thesis and my PhD thesis were in topics in the history of societies before colonialism. So I became interested in archival questions pertaining to that field early on. And I found that I enjoyed archival research and was quite good at it. I enjoyed doing the research and then putting ideas together into a narrative, both the theses that I did at MA level and at PhD level. But of course, that's fairly standard for historians to get in at higher level, doing higher degree theses, to get into archival work. I had no particular notion that the making of archive was an important field of study in its own right. And I didn't really start thinking about that until, in fact, after I'd retired from, I should have said, teaching history at the University of Natal in Pietermaritzburg, where I was for a long time. I retired from that. And soon after that, I was invited by Professor Carolyn Hamilton, who was a longstanding friend and colleague, to join the APC, if we can call it, the Archive and Public Culture Research Initiative, that she was setting up at the University of Cape Town. This would have been about 2008, 2009, somewhere around there, to join the APC as a research associate. And very quickly in the APC, one was thrown into the deep end of, through Carolyn, not very largely her work, of archival thinking, critical archival thinking, and investigating the whole enormous range of archives that historians generally use, but particularly the historians of, we'll call it pre-colonial Southern Africa, shorthand. Although in the book, as you've probably seen, we quite specifically critique that notion of the pre-colonial. Perhaps we can come onto that later on. But anyway, in participating in the workshops and writing of papers in the APC, one learned very quickly a whole range of new ideas about archive and how other people, particularly students, felt about it, and the new ideas that they brought from their own wide range of positions that they occupied, to these seminars. So yeah, that's really how I started off on the archive world. And as Cynthia said, I suppose about 2012, I wanted to pick up on a book on a field that I'd long been interested in, and that was confronting stereotypes. Colonial-made stereotypes, or colonial-era stereotypes, let's say, about the history of Southern Africa before colonialism, which you want to become more and more aware of, over many years of teaching and reading, but they're still very much around in the new South Africa of the time. And a couple of years later, I approached Cynthia with ideas about the book, and it grew from there. Cynthia was a long-standing colleague at the University of the Witwatersrand. I don't remember those arguments, quite honestly. I remember collaborative work and like-minded thinking. Anyway, perhaps you can put it right on that one. And then through the APC was where we both met Amongi Semi, who was associated, who was working in Cape Town at the time, and then ended up in the APC. And we just took our collaboration from there.
Super, thank you. Bongaseni?
Thanks, Jen. So I was born and grew up in northern KwaZulu-Natal, in the town of Ulundi. And I went to university in Durban, at the then University of Natal. I've never studied history formally, actually. So I always say I'm not a historian. I pretend to be one. My interest was always in literary studies, and I studied literature, actually. But my interest in history goes back a long way, actually, to high school, I would say, where I became very interested in what was going on politically in the country, which took me to history, in that I was trying to understand the political violence that was taking place when I was in high school in the 90s. And to understand that, I then found myself reading right back to the Anglo-Zulu War, right? Reading right back to the early 19th century. And then later on, when I went to university and started investigating praise poetry's Bongo and his Thakazelo, I came across John's work and came across the James Stewart Archive, which at first I had great difficulty engaging because it was fashionable at the time in the late 90s and early 2000s to dismiss work like the James Stewart Archive as colonial era work that was produced by a colonial magistrate. It was very fashionable to disavow all of that work. It was really only later when I did my PhD at Columbia that I worked with a historian, Marsha Wright, who then made me properly begin to engage with and think about the James Stewart Archive. And when I came back to South Africa to do fieldwork for my PhD, that was in 2009. In fact, that's where John and I first met. John, you probably don't remember that. I got the job I had in Cape Town, first job in Cape Town, while we were driving through the border, at the border between Mpumalanga and KwaZulu-Natal, with a bunch of farmers who were showing us some of the historical places where some of the wars in the early 19th century may have taken place. And then sort of later on moved to Cape Town and joined the APC, where I got working with John more fully. And again, as both John and Cynthia have explained, the APC is where our collaboration really began and where I got to meet Cynthia as well. So yeah, that's been the journey. My journey has been particularly with the James Stewart Archive, which I've worked with ever since I got to know it as a student in Durban.
Oh, that's fantastic. Thank you. So turning to Archives of Times Past, this book is organized in six sections, and the four chapters of part one, First Thoughts About the Archive, are all co-authored by the group of you. I felt that they put forward a lot of the main goals that you had for this book. Could you share a few of the goals that you lay out for yourselves in that section?
Well, as John has said, his initial idea was to do a book that confronted the standard stereotypes that one finds, especially in pre-colonial history. And perhaps we'll have to explain why I'm putting quotation marks around pre-colonial. So for example, Shaka as the savage king who devastated the whole of Southern Africa, conveniently emptying the land for white people to come along and settle in it. But those kinds of particularly racial stereotypes, around the bushman and with an emphasis on physical attributes of people and so on. And so John was quite keen to do something which would challenge these stereotypes. By then, I'd been teaching for quite a long time at school and also at university where I did a lot of teacher education. And to be honest, I just felt quite cynical about how effective a book like that would be because I felt that I'd been doing a lot of that my whole life. And to me, it didn't seem that it had had very much impact. So we began talking and thinking about it. And one of the things that struck me is I was at university myself as an undergraduate in a very exciting, cutting-edge time of history when people were writing a lot about times past and involved in theory about how to conceptualize societies of that era and so on, and to show how they changed and so on. And yet, and that was in the 70s, and yet by the 2000s, there was so little of that that it made its way into school, but also university curricula. So that was, I started to think about why that was and how we might change that situation. So then I began to be very interested in the idea of doing a book that would assist teachers and students to think about pre-colonial history and to have ways of finding out about it. So that was my angle.
Thank you. I don't know if John and Mbongiseni, you wanted to add anything to that.
Yeah, just to add to that. Yeah, what Cynthia is saying is that we're moving, in fact, from the question of what happened in the past and how to get it right, moving away from that kind of notion, that language, to, well, how do we know about the past before colonialism in the first place? It seems, you know, a much bigger question. It was a question designed to vex students in many ways, because what students want to be told is what happened in the past. And more we are moving away from trying to answer that question, you know, towards a sort of answer, well, you know, we're just historians. We don't know what happened in the past. What we can do is point you to the sources on the past. Now go and look at them. And also, you're moving against the sort of common notion that look at them and make up your own minds. No, we don't want you to make up your own minds. Just keep reading and thinking, reading and thinking. It's a point that we emphasize in the book. You know, it's an ongoing process, never-ending process, is thinking about the archive. And then accompanying that, I think this was Cynthia's influence coming through, and also the APC. Moving from the notion of just a concern with particular sources, like the ones that we cover in section 2 of the book, to the broader question of the actual explorers themselves, the researchers, and their human adventures along the way of getting into the archive. It wasn't just a matter of taking the archive for granted. It was investigating how the archive was made, but also how researchers responded to it, because that shapes very much what they take away from the archive and the way that they write history, you know, their own backgrounds, where they're coming from, what's shaped their own ideas as researchers. And that's what we're moving towards, you know, in this book, encouraging people to write about their own experiences as explorers.
So I would add to that, I think that I mean, my own interest in part was, in my PhD, I was looking at a group of people that were reconstructing identities, and identities that had been erased over 200 years, or suppressed at least. And what became very interesting to me, so someone trying to study the sources, again, that people were using, was the question of, yeah, what were people using to try and reconstruct these identities? And where were they finding the praise poetry that they were trying to reconstruct? And that led, yeah, to a string of sources over 150 years that people were turning to. And it became quite interesting to me to look at what those sources were and look at the circumstances under which those sources themselves had come into being, and look at the ways in which in the present, for purposes of present projects, people were drawing on those past sources. And that those are the kind of questions I was interested in that led to these explorations and to the kind of conversations that we have had over many years at the APC.
Fantastic. Well, John, you already mentioned the second part of the book a little bit. Maybe we can move into that. Parts 2 through 6 of the book feature contributions by other authors, and particularly in part 2, commentaries and conversations, these dive into analysis of a variety of primary and secondary sources commonly used to think about South African history. And you wrote earlier in the book that the question of how to engage critically with source material influenced by colonial ways of thinking is really at the heart of this, as you just said. So could you share a few examples of how part two can prompt us to reimagine, re-examine our engagement with source material and with the archive?
Who is that directed to? Question.
Any of you, whoever would like to share.
Yeah. Where would you like to go? Cynthia?
I think that you or Mbokoseni should start us off, then I'll come in if necessary.
Okay. Well, let me pick up with chapter 9 then. It's one that I've written, Unpacking Olden Times. I think it's a fairly typical example of what we were doing in that second section. You know, Olden Times in Zululand and Natal was written by a missionary historian, Alfred Bryant, and published in 1929, after he'd been doing 40 years of research into what he called Zulu history. It was 700 pages of really tight-packed, tight-packed synthesis of as much as he could find on the oral accounts of dozens and dozens of the little groups and the big groups that lived in KwaZulu-Natal before colonialism. And so after 1929, it became a standard work. It was just easy for people, both white scholars and later on black scholars, simply to pick it up, open it, and largely read it off the page as not necessarily the truth, but as the most conveniently available account. And in that way, it became entrenched right through the study of the Natal region, the KwaZulu-Natal region, before colonial times. And it remained the primary source, the primary secondary source, if I can put it that way, the main secondary source, right up until the 1970s. When the first volumes of the James Stewart archive that we've spoken about already started appearing and providing the basis for challenging a lot of what Bryant had written, if students, readers, writers, academics were prepared to do the research necessary in the Stewart archive, which is, it's a difficult thing to use, much more difficult than Bryant. But Bryant's still today, I mean, for 40, 50 years on, it still remains an indispensable source. Not so much as a correct or right account in its own right, but as a source material. It's an archival work now with lots of little bits and pieces that can be teased out of it with careful critical thinking. And the chapter I wrote was really about Bryant and how he put that work together and the its strengths, how it came to be published, its strengths, its weaknesses, and why there's a great need to be careful with it in using it. And the same sort of points apply to the other works in that section. Makema Fuze, Abantu Abamnyama, a basic source book, synthesis book in isiZulu, published in 1922. Rachel King, An Archive in an Old Tin Trunk. That chapter is essentially about David Frédéric Elonberger. He was one of the French-Swiss missionaries in Lesotho in the late 1900s. And in 1912, published The History of the Basotho, which today, more than a century later, is still a standard work that people just largely dip into without in a much by way of critical analysis. Unlike Bryant has been overtaken by Stewart these other works, in many cases, have not been overtaken in a similar kind of way. So they're still used too uncritically in our views. And then there was Making Tribal Histories, the work of Paul Leonard Preutz, a controversial character who came out to South Africa from Germany after the Second World War and became a major ethnographer and historian of Tswana-speaking peoples. Again, his works are very largely used uncritically because there's nothing else in many cases. And then chapter 8 took a slightly different turn. Here we approached Sikiba Dikwati to write on his own researches into Nicholas von Warmelo, who'd been a major ethnographer in South Africa from the 1920s right through to the 1960s. And he's written again a number of works which are simply standard works today, largely used uncritically. In the end, Sikiba wasn't able to find the time to actually get down to writing, so we ended up having a couple of very interesting conversations with him, Cynthia and I did, and it's those that we've put into the book. So it's that kind of work that section 2 of Archives of Time Past tries to do. Look critically at what remain standard sources in a century on.
Great, thank you. And then looking at part 3, Mongoseni, I think this is something that you spoke to a little earlier as well. This section is called Becoming Explorers, and it engages with contributors who are reflecting on their initial engagement with archives and their personal process and learning. Could you share more about some of the material covered in part 3?
I mean, I think the key thing for us is, again, this question of what journeys have different contributors had as scholars with these particular archives that they work on. Partly, I mean, I think as has been said, as a way of demonstrating that archives themselves are not static, right? Demonstrating that any archive that one engages with was made in a particular moment by a particular set of people under particular circumstances. In order to be able to work fruitfully with an archive, one can't simply go and extract nuggets of fact, as John, I think, has talked about. But one also needs to go further to think about the circumstances under which that archive came into existence. And so the explorers that we have, the contributors that became explorers in part 3, these different authors, Mucha Parara Musenwa, Lisa Krill, Nduguyake Ndlovu, John himself, of course, on the James Stewart Archive, and how they themselves have come to work or have worked with these archives over their careers. So that's chapters 10 to 13 in part 3. So they explore how their own careers have unfolded and how archives have come to define their careers or engagement with particular archives, their own changing ideas about those particular archives at different times. So Mucham Semwa, for example, his chapter deals with how he became an environmental historian, thinking about the way in which studying nature is something that was in some ways not part of the world in which he grew up. And he had to journey into thinking about nature as an archive of sorts. So I think that's what we were trying to get at here. That the person working with a particular archive also comes at it from a very particular location themselves, and the journey with the archives itself, with an archive itself, I think becomes something that both makes the person in certain ways, but also the archive itself in those journeys is something that comes to take on particular meanings for the person. I'm going to ask John to talk about his own contribution to that section on the James Stewart Archive.
Well, I've already said quite a lot, so I'll keep it short. That chapter of mine just simply describes how I became involved in working on the James Stewart Archive from 1971 onwards. And it's more than 50 years ago. Wow. And still ongoing, actually, work that Mongaseni and I are doing. In between times. James Stewart was a, a magistrate and colonial official in colonial Natal in the 1890s into the early 20th century. And from about 1897 to 1922, he spent much of his spare time in deliberately approaching knowledgeable Africans about the past, before colonial times, and during colonial times, actually, as well. I mustn't get that wrong. And discussing their knowledge of the past in great detail, and then making notes of what they told him. Sometimes verbatim, but more often a paraphrasing of what they were telling him, because he couldn't write down everything. And those notes he managed to keep safe, you know, for the rest of his life in Natal, and for the rest of his life in London. He moved to London in 1922. And they survived the Blitz in southeast London in the 1940s after his death. They were being cared for by his widow. And there's another whole story about the actual notes themselves that needs to be told. The making of the collection, the James Stewart collection, and its fate over time. And how eventually his widow sold the collection back to Killy Campbell, who was a noted collector in Durban in the late 1940s. And so they came back, actually, to South Africa, where they belonged in the first place. But there were all sorts of little slips and slides along the way. The collection might never have come into existence, or it might have been lost, it might have been bombed, it might have been bought by some rich Americans, and ended up there, Northwestern, Michigan, somewhere like that. But fortunately, it's in Durban and is slowly becoming a standard source, but the most important source on the history of the KwaZulu-Natal region before the colonial period. It's a must. It just cannot be missed. Again, I should say it's a difficult source to use. It's not a narrative history. It's not even a synthesis. It's simply Stewart's notes of what interested his discussants to talk about, what interested him to talk about at any particular time. And so they're disjointed, they move backwards and forwards, they jump from one subject to another, largely in English, but often also in isiZulu. And we translated those in editing the James Stewart Archive. And the more I personally research with the James Stewart Archive, the published archive, the more I wish, the more I need to consult the originals. Fortunately, I have my own set of photocopies of the originals, the ones that I worked with. But I'm in a very fortunate position that way among researchers. Most of them don't. But it's absolutely essential to go back to the originals if one's doing serious research in that period. The James Stewart Archive is a very important first pass, as it were, and second pass and third pass into the James Stewart collection in Killy Campbell. But in the end, the final pass is made in Killy Campbell Library itself with the originals. Carolyn Hamilton and I have written together on this subject, and we can't stress too strongly that the James Stewart Archive published is not the same thing as the James Stewart collection, even if it's based on that collection. So just a warning to listeners.
Yeah, well, those personal experiences with the archive are, I mean, as you said, Mongaseni, never static, always different, always changing, and those opportunities to be with the archive itself are so valuable. I was really intrigued by the fourth part of the book because you bring us to archives that aren't what we might think of as a traditional archive. Rock art and archaeology rather than file boxes and documents. Throughout the book, I felt that you were really prompting the reader to be open to various forms of archives, language, water, rocks. Could one of you share more about the contributions in part four and what led you to include those types of archives in the book?
Cynthia, I think you can talk broadly first. Perhaps I can follow after that.
Well, I could probably speak for John and me at least, not for Mongaseni, because he comes from a slightly different disciplinary angle, as he was explaining. But John and I are very used to being conventional historians and very text-bound. So for us, visual stuff is quite challenging. We had to be taught in a way to look and to think, not to think of visual material as other than illustration, you know, just a pretty picture of rock art or something. But well, I think John had a better introduction to that than I did. But it was so exhilarating to learn to engage with these and to engage with the really interesting debates that exist around rock art in South Africa. And so that's why we decided we had to include that. And we had a lot of debates about, does that mean that anything's an archive? You know, because Mongaseni mentioned thinking about the environment in terms of archive, which is what Mucha Masemwa does in his chapter in the preceding section. He talks about becoming an environmental historian and the environment becomes his archive. But then does that mean that you could just say that anything was an archive? And we had these long, really amazing debates and kind of tearing out our hair. But yes, that was very exciting. And we have a lot of really cutting-edge research to work off in South Africa. So that's what I would say in the way of a general introduction.
John or Mongaseni, do you want to add to that?
So I think...
If I could add again from the archaeology side. If you're working in the past before colonial times, in Southern Africa, the work of archaeologists is just unavoidable. The archaeology as a discipline has been going nearly as long as history has in South Africa since the early 20th century. But they've very largely followed quite separate trails. There was a brief moment in the 1970s when they started coming together. They've largely separated again. And of course, I probably hardly need to say that archaeology is a very esoteric subject for the outsider. Processes of excavation, thinking, curating, you know, it's got its own disciplinary rules. But for the historian working on the past before colonialism in Southern Africa, there's no option, if you're a serious scholar, but to learn those rules. And to some extent, to get into what archaeologists do and understand what they do, how they make evidence, what they call evidence, what their archive is. In other words, material objects that are buried in the ground, which they excavate, and then really turn into an archive by curating, sorting, labeling, and giving meaning to, putting into boxes, which they then label, curate, etc., etc. That whole process of labeling and curating, as we've tried to emphasize in that photo essay in the book, is absolutely essential again to the way of organizing knowledge. So one has to learn how to do that, to take archaeology as a discipline, you know, very seriously, as well as working with conventional written documents. And we chose, you know, three scholars there, whom we knew and who we could rely on to tell a good story, which I think they've all three of them done. And Amanda Isserhazen, Jeff Blundell, Justine Vincius. There are many, many other stories that could be told about archaeology by many other archaeologists. But archaeology in South Africa still has a tradition of being done by old white men with beards and in khaki. And these three just very much stand outside that tradition and broken away from it. So that's largely why we chose them. Yeah. And then as far as material objects are concerned, again, we need to think of what the archaeologists find as material objects. They put them into museums. These are paralleled by ethnographic objects in museums. And again, the whole story of ethnography in South Africa is one that needs to be taught and told critically. But in my own case, I wasn't interested in objects, material objects. You know, what were these things lying around the museums? They meant nothing. And it really took me being taken in hand by numbers of colleagues in the APC, at the University of Cape Town, you know, quite late in my career, to start educating me into the importance of material objects as archival objects. In other words, showing me that they had a history. And Justine Vincius particularly was important here because she's made a career of writing biographies of material objects, like she does in this book, where she writes the biography of a particular rock painting and how she traces its story through visiting numbers of archives in South Africa and in Germany. So it's that sort of work that started appealing to me, and I began to start understanding a little bit more about how material objects could have historical value in their own right.
Fantastic. Thank you. Mbongiseni, did you want to add to that discussion of part four?
I was just going to, I think, mention briefly that, actually it's occurred to me now in this conversation that my own interest has been also in the oral, right, which one cannot capture in a book like this. I mean, there's some, in the next section that we'll talk about, there's some element of that in Grant McNulty's contribution. But what's also been fascinating to me over time is to work with material that was recorded in writing in the 19th century and how in some instances that gets re-oralized, right, when it gets taken up by people in the present, which is really the subject, I suppose, of the next section.
Yeah, thank you. Well, then maybe we can move to talking about part five, which is called Conflicting Opinions. And there are three contributions here by scholars and teachers who are interested in complicating popular historical narratives. Mbongiseni, do you want to start by sharing some of the arguments that those contributors are making?
So part five, of course, I mean, are contributions by Sfiso Mxolisi Ndlovu, Himal Ramji, and Grant McNulty. And I'm going to focus on Grant McNulty's very interesting contribution there. So I mentioned earlier that there's also a time in South Africa when histories before colonialism become quite interesting publicly, and people become quite interested in rediscovering their histories and remaking their identities. So one of the things that we did alongside, I think, the APC that we've talked about, was there was also another project that was looking at the ways in which archival materials were being taken up and used by people in the present, in post-apartheid South Africa. And what was happening there is it was around some of the sort of restorative justice interventions of the post-apartheid government around land reform, for example, and around chieftaincy claims, going back to try and undo and redo some of what had been done to political systems in the region by colonial rule. So the chieftaincy disputes and claims, where there was a commission that was going back to try and establish who was a legitimate chief in the present. So people turned to archives, and archives became got quite a big purchase in public discourse in the 2000s. In fact, right up to until the present, where some of these claims and disputes are still ongoing. And so McNulty traces one of these groupings that the historians of which themselves, come up with very conflicting histories of the same group, partly because the archival materials to which they turn and the sources that they use are very different, right, made at different times by different people who themselves were telling their histories of different groups that were in different places geographically at different times. That's what that particular chapter deals with, and it shows how present, right, some of the archival materials become at particular moments because of particular political pressures, because of particular discourses that become popular in the present. So people start reaching for archival materials and often, again, reading them very uncritically. And what we're trying to show here, what the authors are trying to show in this section, is that certain archives, when they get taken up, or in case of, the contribution by Sifiso Ndlovu, how some archives remain neglected. But when they do become gain public attention, they can be taken up in such vastly different ways and be used to tell such vastly different and conflicting stories, or how people use different archives to tell different stories and while claiming to be talking about the same thing. That's what we've seen, I think, in the present when people begin to reach back for material that's sitting in archives, and when they reach back into different archives that were made at different times.
Thank you. Then moving on to the final section of the book, this describes more and illustrates the way the archive is understood. And there's a really terrific photo essay that shows that diversity. But I'm interested in how this concluding section brings us back to a question that you ask really early on. Where are the deep conversations about the past? So Cynthia, maybe I'll start by posing this question to you, and then others can add on to it. Well, you speak really clearly about the situation of South Africa. How do you think or hope that non-South African readers might apply the questions you ask to their contexts? What are the lessons about master narratives, historical stereotypes, and archival forms that you hope all readers might apply to their use of archives and their study of history?
Wow, that's a really challenging question, of course. I'll attempt a bit of an answer. I mean, for me, one of the great things about doing this book and working with the contributors and John Borgeseni is learning to do Anne Laura Stoller has called reading with the grain as well as reading against the grain. And so John's talked quite a lot about the James Stewart archive, but we also have the archive that Lisa Creel describes, for example, and Carl Hoffman and his interlocutors, or Sakiba and von Barmelo's interlocutors. And so I began to get a really exciting sense of how these interlocutors can speak to us. And I think Morgoseni's indicated that people used to be very skeptical of this being possible and saying, well, it's just colonial, it's all mediated by colonial agents and so on. But I began to get a sense of how you could actually hear these people. So James Stewart, because he was so conscientious, is the best example of that. But, you know, I began to ask questions like, but who were these old men? One of them was 89 years old, and he made this incredibly arduous journey to come and speak to James Stewart. So instead of asking, what was James Stewart doing? Why was he wanting to speak to old people about Zulu so-called history? I began to think about, but why did these old people come to talk to him? And what were they actually trying to tell him? And why did they think it was so important? And I think those ideas are probably generalizable. I mean, we could only deal with a small section of South African history, actually. And so all the time we were conscious that we wanted to suggest certain principles or ideas that could be applied elsewhere in the country as well as more broadly. Yeah.
John, was there anything else that you wanted to share about this project before we wrap up?
I'm ready just to say, repeat, I suppose, what we've really been talking about this last hour. What we're trying to do in the book is show the various kinds of archive that we deal with. And again, it's only a small section of archive that we deal with in any detail. But to show it as not inert, it's not just out there to go and be paged through or looked at and then written about. It's a archive is a living entity. It's rethought, recatalogued, reworked, relabeled, given new meanings all the time. And so the business of it's asking the question, how was the archive made in the first place? It's fundamentally important. How did it come into existence? And how did some things not come into existence? Equally important if you get it that way. How was the archive made? Why is it being remade? You won't understand it unless you delve deeply into those sort of questions. Get an idea of where it's coming from and who's saying what and why. And how a particular object came to be made, shaped, and why. And then in parallel with that, and perhaps we could have said more about this, is the problems involved in doing this. It's not just a matter of reading off the page. It's a matter of getting behind the written page, if we're dealing with documents, written documents, and asking these critical questions about where the archive comes from, but also engaging with the concepts which give it shape and which give your own reading of it shape. So archive is always problematic to use, and one has to keep those problems in front all the time in working with the archive. What are the problems of dealing with the source? You can't just take it for granted. Now, let me stop there.
Thank you. Vangasini, I will give you the last word here. Is there anything else that you would like to share or other questions that you want folks to be thinking about related to this work?
So let me maybe end with two things I want to say. So I think the first thing I want to talk about is, John and Cynthia have indicated how most of the archives we're talking about were made in circumstances of colonial domination. And one of the difficulties, in reference Cynthia made to Sifiso Ndlovu's work, is also that in engaging archives, one is also sometimes looking for one's own story in the archive. You're looking to find your own history in the archive. And the difficulty with engaging with archives made in colonial context is precisely what Cynthia was referring to, right? Sometimes you find that they paint your own people in such negative light. And you've got to work through the difficulty, right? To be able to engage the archive, you've got to work through the difficulty of the way in which people you identify with are represented in the archive. But you've also then got to get beyond that. And that's partly the work that engaging with past, before colonialism, is about. It's partly the work that it asks of us who engage with the archive to do. But the last thing I want to say is, this was also, I think, a very difficult book, and John and Cynthia could talk more eloquently about that, to make, because most of the contributors to the book do not think about the archives they work with in the way that they were asked to do for the book. So the authors themselves were being asked to take a step back from the work, the run-of-the-mill work that they've done, where they are just going in and out of archives, they're reading things back and forth to actually reflect on their journeys with these particular materials, with these particular archives. And that made this book, you know, and the process of the making of this book itself, a process of deep reflection, a process of engaging with the author's own ways from a bit of a distance, own ways of working with these archives. And so I think John and Cynthia would agree that from when you conceptualized the book to when we actually got the book published, it took many, many years. Because many people just do not think about the materials they work with in the ways that we've asked authors to do for this book.
Fantastic. I hope that process of reflection that you engaged folks with for writing this book is inspiring to other people working on other projects. Well, Cynthia, John, and Bongasani, thank you so much for your time today. And once again, my guests today are the editors of Archives of Times Past, published by Wits University Press. My name is Jen Hoyer, and you are listening to the Scholarly Communications Channel of the New Books Network.